Support comes from the Missouri Forest Products Association, honoring Arbor Day on April 26th, with an ongoing commitment to sustainable stewardship and conservation of Missouri's forests. Choosewood.com.
Welcome to St. Louis on the Air. I'm Jason Rosenbaum. Janet Napolitano has charted a storied career in public service, including her tenure as University of California president, Arizona governor, and U.S. attorney. But Napolitano is perhaps best known for her time as Secretary of Homeland Security, experience she details in her new book, How Safe Are We? Homeland Security Since 9/11. Napolitano is in St. Louis this evening to speak at Maryville University, and she joins us in studio right now. Welcome, Madam Secretary, and thank you so much for your time this afternoon. I understand from talking with you, you have some St. Louis ties, and you're not unfamiliar to this area.
That's right. My mother's family was from St. Louis. She grew up in Kirkwood, and then my grandparents ultimately retired to Ellisville. So we spent many summers in St. Louis.
Well, it's a great region, and we're happy to have you back. Part of your book details your observations about homeland security and immigration policy in the present day compared to your experience. I'll start off very simply. What are your observations about how the Trump administration is handling immigration policy?
Well, I think I'll talk about the wall because that is the focus of the Trump administration policy. And I'll just say flat out that a wall is a symbol. It's not a strategy. You cannot seal the Southwest border. It's 1,940 miles long, very different kinds of terrain. There's public lands, there's private lands, there's sovereign Indian nations along the border. It's our number two trading partner, so thousands of vehicles need to go through there every day through the ports of entry. So a strategy rather than a wall, a strategy involves more manpower, technology like ground sensors and tunnel detectors, air cover across the entire border.
Like drones, for example.
Like drones, exactly. And then strengthening the actual ports of entry.
And the question I've always wanted to ask for people that are proponents of the wall, I imagine as Arizona governor and as U.S. attorney when you dealt with drug interdiction issues, people can dig under walls and dig tunnels. I mean, wouldn't that be kind of a problem, even if you built this wall, that, you know, gangs could just build tunnels under the wall, basically?
Oh absolutely. There are tunnels. Most of the illegal narcotics entering the country actually come hidden in vehicles through the ports of entry. But when I was governor of Arizona, I used to say, show me a 10-foot wall, and I'll show you an 11-foot ladder. So either way, a wall won't solve any problem that we have.
What is your reaction, though, when you see American voters get viscerally into the idea of a wall? Because I've gone to some Donald Trump rallies. I hear the chants of build the wall. And I think that everyday people hear the president talk about this and even shut down the government because of this. And they feel like a real emotional connection to what he's doing.
Yeah, so this is where politics interferes with real homeland security. So real homeland security is evaluating risk, dealing with risk pragmatically, doing everything you can to protect the safety of the American people, realizing that there are no guarantees, so you're in the risk reduction business, and speaking honestly and forthrightly with the American people about what works and what doesn't. And I'm afraid we've kind of fallen into some political traps here, and I think it's going to take us a while to dig our way out, so to speak.
Another aspect of President Trump's immigration policy that has elicited a lot of controversy is the detention of families. I'm interested to hear what your observations are of that part, because I know that one of the things that the current Homeland Security Secretary has said, that a lot of these policies started under the Obama administration, which a lot of people in that administration have pushed back against. So I have the source right here. I'd like to hear your thoughts on that particular part of immigration policy.
We had no zero tolerance policy. We had no policy on separating children from their parents or their families at the border. There were some rare instances where separation occurred when, for example, a child was found traveling with an adult not related to them, where human trafficking was suspected or something of that sort, but nowhere near the policy and the kinds of disruption that we saw at the border over the summer.
You talk a lot in your book lamenting the inability for Congress to come up with a comprehensive solution to immigration policy, which has been elusive during the George W. Bush administration, the Barack Obama administration, and I don't see that happening under a divided Congress. Why do you think it's so hard to come up with something? I have my own theories, but I'd like to hear from you about why there's no consensus on this issue.
Yeah, that's a good question. Immigration has always been a tough issue in the United States, and we've had waves of anti-immigrant feeling from the 19th century when it was anti-German to the early 20th century when it was anti-Irish, anti-Italian, anti-Jewish, and now anti-Hispanic. And what happens each time there's a wave of migration is people still come. Ultimately, they integrate into our country. They make our country stronger. Immigration politics, emanates from some of those anti-immigrant sentiments. And it's a very difficult issue. I'll give you that. But it is one that permits of a solution if reasonable people will get together.
Missouri has a relatively small percentage of Latino residents compared to Arizona, for example. And I think because of that, you see statewide candidates in both parties, including Democrats, really try to showcase how hardline they are on immigration. Whereas I see even Republicans in the state that you used to lead, like John McCain and Jeff Flake, really try to take a much softer edge to that. Is it just because a lot of the lawmakers in Congress don't have Latino or Hispanic representation that is as robust as, you know, the states like you used to lead, and that could be one of the reasons there could be a deadlock on this issue?
Well, I do think some familiarity with the border really helps, because you understand the border can't be sealed like a Ziploc bag. It's a zone. It's not one kind of line. So I think some familiarity with just the geography of the place matters. I think the more people see communities who are coming from different countries and see how they're working and how they're putting their energies into the country, the less adverse they are.
You know, it's weird to talk about your book by talking about another book, but I read former Attorney General John Ashcroft's memoir a few months ago, and he was talking about coming up with very impactful policy during the aftermath of 9/11 and kind of developing very important things during a crisis situation. You were Homeland Security Secretary when, for the most part, the nation's attention had turned toward the economy and the economic collapse. I'm really curious to hear what dynamic that created during your tenure. Did it make it easier to formulate policy, given that all eyes weren't necessarily on you, or was there still a lot of residual attention to your department and the issue of security, even though the Great Recession was kind of the main issue?
There was still considerable attention paid to Homeland Security. You know, the creation of the Department of Homeland Security was the largest reorganization of the federal government since the creation of the Department of Defense in the aftermath of World War II. A lot of our work was integrating these previously separate 22 agencies, and plus a few new ones that got created out of whole cloth, putting them under one umbrella, a common mission statement, common set of priorities, so that whether you came from the Coast Guard or FEMA or the Secret Service or Customs and Border Protection or ICE, everybody knew what we were striving for, which was to have a safe and secure homeland where the American way of life can thrive.
What would you say was your most difficult experience as Homeland Security Secretary?
There were lots. Well, we've talked about immigration reform and our inability to get that done. And that was a real disappointment. One tough time was Christmas Day of 2009 when we had the underwear bomber. Mm-hmm. This was an individual who had bomb material in his underwear, got on a plane in Lagos, Nigeria, transferred planes in Amsterdam, and was en route to Detroit and tried to ignite the explosives in his underwear once the plane got into U.S. airspace. And, that should never have happened. And in reverse engineering, how did this guy get on a plane with explosives sewn in his underwear? We realized there were some real gaps in our aviation system globally, and we set about to cure those gaps. But that was a tough time, no doubt.
I think whenever we talk about Homeland Security, the question of security versus liberty comes into play, especially when you're talking about like going through airport checkpoints and having to like take off your shoes or take off your belt or go through X-ray detectors and other fancy machinery. I'm sure that you encountered a lot of that, especially when you were talking with lawmakers about policy or just everyday people with policy. Is that just going to be kind of an internal struggle going forward about trying to make sure that we are doing all we can as a country to protect against terrorism versus not being so locked down that the freedom of movement kind of comes to a halt? I'd be interested to hear what you have to say about that.
So there's a constant struggle between security and civil liberties and privacy. And the way we try to address it is to say, look, privacy, civil liberties, that's part of the American way of life. So whenever we're instituting a new practice or a policy or a new technology, we need to build in from the get-go the concept of privacy by design. So, for example, those airport body scanners, we needed those because of the kinds of threats that we were getting and the continued efforts to get explosives onto airplanes. But the contract that we let for that machinery quickly moved from a total body image to just a silhouette. It had protections in it that the person who actually sees the silhouette is not the person who's standing at the scanning machine. Nothing can be downloaded. Nothing can be transferred. So we built into it this concept of, yes, there's going to be a momentary look to see if there's anything that requires a secondary inspection, but we're going to do everything we can to protect privacy in the meantime.
I guess it's been about 18 years since 9/11. The title of your book is How Safe Are We Since Then? How safe are we since 9/11? What gaps do you think that there are still in the Homeland Security apparatus in this country?
Well, I think we're actually safer, much safer in many respects than we were prior to 9/11. For example, the notion that a foreign national can come to the United States, go to flight school, get on an aircraft, take over the cockpit, weaponize the airliner, and fly it into an iconic building like the World Trade Center or the Pentagon, that really can't happen anymore. But
why?
There are new because we did a number of things. For example, we keep better track of foreign nationals at our flight schools. We hardened the cockpit door on airplanes. We instituted a rule that if your luggage goes on a plane, you have to go on the plane with the luggage. You can't just get a suitcase into the cargo hold. So, some of those very pragmatic steps taken immediately have really eliminated that threat. Threats continue to evolve. And in my book, I point out three that I think are key right now. One are the threats from cyber and cybersecurity. One are threats from mass gun violence. And one are threats related to global warming and climate change. All three of these affect the safety and security of the American people.
You also delve into kind of your backstory in this book and your rise throughout Arizona politics. And there was one issue in particular that caught my attention that you and former Maricopa County Sheriff Joe Arpaio had an unlikely kind of alliance during one of your campaigns. You weren't political allies, obviously. And I'm mentioning this because he recently came to speak in St. Louis County and it caused a big stir because of his reputation. Was there a time you and Sheriff Joe were on the same page on something? I'd be interested to hear about that.
No, we weren't on the same page, but Arpaio had been a former Fed. He'd been a former DEA special agent in charge. When he was elected sheriff in Maricopa County, Arizona, Maine Justice in Washington, D.C. opened up an investigation into conditions at the jail. I was the U.S. attorney in Arizona at the time, and I helped, and my office helped broker a civil consent decree with respect to those conditions moving forward. And I think Arpaio always thought that I didn't play politics with that, that you know, called it as I saw it and was a straight shooter. So he said to my campaign staff, look, if anybody misstates Janet's record as U.S. attorney, I'll go on and straighten him out. And my opponent was getting ready to put out a very misleading and ugly ad, and Arpaio lived up to his word.
Are you surprised with what how his political persona has evolved and how he's become kind of like he's become very controversial among the left, but he's become kind of a folk hero among Donald Trump supporters. Does that surprise you at all?
Yes. You know, when I first met Joe, I was introduced to him by Dennis DeConcini, who was the Democratic U.S. Senator from Arizona. And he and Joe were good friends. And, you know, Joe was always a bit of a character, but his anti-immigrant rhetoric and his absolute almost abuse of inmates really evolved over time. And I think he started reading his press too much as well.
We only have about 40 seconds left. If you had one message to provide to the American people about the state of Homeland Security that you could say in a very short amount of time, what would it be?
I would say we're safer now, but every American has a part to play.
Well, Madam Secretary, I want to thank you, and I hope you enjoy your time in St. Louis. I know, as you mentioned, it's not the first time you've been back, but the Secretary is the author of How Safe Are We? Homeland Security Since 9/11. She'll be discussing her book tonight at 7 p.m. at Maryville University. Thank you very much again for joining us today. This is St. Louis on the Air on St. Louis Public Radio, 90.7 KWMU.
We have a staffing announcement. Don Marsh resigned as host of St. Louis on the Air on Wednesday, March 27th. We want to thank him for his more than 13 years as host. Until a permanent replacement is found, reporters and producers will fill in.
Support comes from the Missouri Forest Products Association, honoring Arbor Day on April 26th, with an ongoing commitment to sustainable stewardship and conservation of Missouri's forests. ChooseWood.com.
The Gateway brings you the day's news from the St. Louis region and across Missouri. It also includes stories from the Illinois side of the river and our Metro East reporter, Will Bauer.
In Alton, in Belleville, in East St. Louis, in Edwardsville, in Cahokia Heights, at Scott Air Force Base, I'm Will Bauer, St. Louis Public Radio.
Listen to reports from Will and all of our journalists weekdays on the Gateway, on the STLPR app, and wherever you get podcasts.